Welcome back to Phantom Island. My name is Stephen Godfrey. Episode 2, we're already changing the format. Still Phantom Island. Let's get the branding right, okay? But we have a new series that's going to appear in the Phantom Island feed. You're going to learn a lot more about it. Hopefully you're going to like it. It's called Numbers and Words. Numbers and Words basically means that a very, very renowned expert non-math idiot, which is myself, and you know, you might identify with that classification as well, I will be proxy, hopefully, for an audience trying to learn more from someone in the world of sports data, advanced stats, analytics, whatever we're calling it on social media this week. So for this week's episode of Numbers and Words, the debut, I had a single question back in my comfy home area of college football. I had a single question based off of a kind of like a hypothesis I built starting in the 2024 college football season, but you noticed it as the transfer portal started. I'm not going to tell you what it is. You have to listen to the episode. It's about one position group. And I took that question to Parker Fleming from Stats of War. He's worked at a bunch of different places in the world of college football analytics and advanced quant. I'm just using all the math words today. Parker is at Stats of War on social media. He's got a couple announcements that are coming soon. So if you want to learn more from him, CFB graphs, if you are in the world of college football on social media, you've seen Parker's work, especially on those Sundays after a big game. Check him out at Stats of War. So I asked Parker a question. We walked it out, took a hypothesis that was just sort of eye test, just, you know, my gut, my non-math gut, my took 6 years to finish college in Mississippi non-math gut. And then I took it to a highly intelligent person, and we walked out what applied, what didn't, and if there was something to this. And yes, this is one of the most volatile sports in the world right now, college football, in terms of trying to understand context and precedent and just the weird jello-like nature of applying something that happened in 2024 to something that happened in 2019 or 2004. Right, this sport is changing so rapidly, it's really hard to keep your perspective. It's going to make you seasick, right? So Parker and I are going to do our level best to draw out some things in the transfer portal era as it applies to the football on the field, the football on the field specifically. So I hope you enjoy. We have a ton of things to tell you about very soon. Most of the early stages of the Phantom Island journey are basically shrouded, covered in fog. We're going to tell you where to subscribe. We've got a bunch of exciting announcements coming up, a bunch of new show formats, all that kind of stuff. All of it's coming soon. Please be patient. But you don't have to be patient about home field apparel. In fact, I would encourage a sort of reckless consumption mentality at homefieldapparel.com. You go to homefieldapparel.com, proudly sponsoring Phantom Island, this program that you're listening to right now. You got the Class of 25 sale because it's graduation time, so you can use the code grads25 at checkout for 30% off select items. You go, look, you know, you can be team agnostic. You just go for it. You find something stylish. Do I have a personal connection with the 1980s italicized Oklahoma logo on a trucker hat? No, but it would probably look good. Am I inexorably drawn to the 80s style Notre Dame baseball pullover? Yeah. Does that make sense? Absolutely not. You just go for it. Oh, man, look at that heavyweight tee for the Florida Gators national championship in the old basketball. That's a Gator playing basketball. Why would you not want to display that? Bring a little joy to the world. Go to homefieldapparel.com. Proud sponsors of Phantom Island. This is Parker Fleming. Welcome to Numbers and Words.
I am Parker Fleming. You might know me from Twitter at Stats of War. I am the creator of CFB Graphs, a college football stats website. And from that have done a bunch of data out there, expected points added, game stat advanced previews, and a bunch of, you know, player data and eval and graphs on Twitter over the last couple of years.
Okay. My name is Stephen Godfrey, and I failed calculus for business 3 times at Ole Miss. Parker, I had a question that I asked you offline, and I genuinely think it's a good one, but I have absolutely no idea to know if I'm right or wrong, or if it's just something that's kind of silly in the portal era, which is that offensive line as a position group and sort of as a culture has always been defined as a unit, We talk about offensive linemen as a unit. We celebrate great championship teams for usually having really talented players recruited, 4- and 5-star players recruited and developed. We like to use that word a lot, right? And what that really meant for basically all of college football up until about 3 years ago was like, we're going to get really talented guys and they're going to be in our system and we're going to redshirt them and we're going to get them bigger and stronger and better. And they're all going to be, is another big cliche word, cohesive. We're going to have, and they know each other and they're going to act as one. And a funny thing happened, if anyone's been paying attention to the sport, the entire concept of roster building died in a fire about 3 years ago with the advent of the transfer portal. So for better or worse, whatever you think of the transfer portal, I would say for the average casual, it seems like a wide receiver who changes offenses is not the necessarily going to experience the biggest learning curve. But an offensive lineman, it seems like flipping those guys in and out is going to change college football. So I asked you, is this showing up in any way, shape, or form in terms of continuity? Because this is what we preached, right? We said continuity is the key to a great offensive line. Is that showing up at any level of college football?
Yeah, I think there's two kind of ways to think about this, that the two traditional things we know to be true about college football offensive lines are, one, what I kind of call the Wisconsin model that you alluded to of, hey, we're drafting or not drafting, it's college. We're recruiting, big guys who might need to develop into their bodies and and can plug and play, over a couple of years in our system. We get them to the program, we feed them, we beef them up in the offseason, and then they can start. You're effectively not turning over more than two guys a year. So you do have this kind of bulk of continuity year over year. And guys are starting late into their sophomore year and then starting sophomore, junior, senior, and you're kind of transitioning through an offensive line. You're not replacing them year over year. The second feature that is kind of a traditional thing that is turned on its head right now is, traditionally, offensive lines have been a weak link unit. And I mean that in the sense of, like a quarterback or a wide receiver, one guy in that room can change your ceiling dramatically, right? The best guy, if your wide receiver 3 stinks, whatever, don't throw it to him, right? Mm-hmm. If your wide receiver 1 is a stud, you're going to get yards. In offensive line, we've kind of thought of it as a weak link system, where if you have a glaring hole in your offensive line, people are going to be able to exploit it. The matchups are going to be there, and that's going to throw a wrench in what you want to be able to do. So the first one we could talk about, turnover, but as for the strong and weak link, we've seen that flipped on its head. Teams like Georgia Tech, you watched them against Florida State at the beginning last year and you thought, hey, they're doing something funky, and they just didn't like one side of their line, and they thought, you know what, we're just going to run behind the good offensive linemen, we're going to completely read off the backside, and we're just going to totally step aside the fact that we have an entire side of the line that is not up to par, and we're going to run behind them with success. You saw Vanderbilt with great success this year, our guys over there kind of doing the fast and quick offensive line, switching those guys to the power side and mm-hmm. not having those traditional positions. People are getting innovative as to the turnover of talent, and we're seeing schematic creativity flourish and kind of overcome this idea that you're only as good as your worst offensive lineman.
It's really funny, because the first thing that springs to mind is, if you say a weak link offensive line, I'm remembering a little bit of trouble with a snap for the old Alabama Crimson Tide in a fairly important game. And then on the opposite side of the ball, it may have been the last time we might ever see something like this, but Michigan kind of rode an offensive line through most of their crucial games on the way to that national championship. Can it still be defined as a weak link system?
Yeah, I think insofar as weak link doesn't necessarily refer to the quality of the offensive line overall, but mm-hmm. saying, 1 through 5, there are ways to start to scheme around, hey, we've got some underdeveloped or maybe not top tier talent players there. In college football, just given the inherent developmental nature that even among this gigantic migration of talent and reshuffling and everything is not going to go away, a solid offensive line, like building through the trenches, is going to take you so far. What's the best team with a bad offensive line in college football? Like, I think you might argue that it's like a Georgia Tech, because they were able to scheme around it. But like, in reality, there's really not a good team that doesn't have a good offensive line.
Yeah, I'm struggling here just off the top of my head, going through playoff qualifiers and then the teams right below that. I don't think you can qualify any of them as saying they had a bad line. Now, it does seem like maybe it's possible to hide because of the systems now. Is that any different because of the portal, or is that just a change in schematic football?
Yeah, a friend of mine, Brandon Thorne, who does a lot of really good NFL offensive line analysis, said on a podcast last year that's kind of stuck in my head, the way to help your offensive lines and to hide them is to run a lot and to do a lot of RPO and play action. And I think we're seeing trends in college football to back that up. I did some clustering and kind of grouped some offensive lines. And, you know, the familiar ones stood out, like the Kiffin offenses, that kind of tree. Tennessee, Ole Miss were going to be very much play action screen, RPO, get the ball out quick, get it to your playmakers. But overall, we're seeing since 2019, we're seeing about 3% increase year over year in RPO usage, according to charted data from SIS. So the advent of the RPO and incorporating that more, I think, is definitely a way to hide against some of those offensive lines. 2024 was the first year in the past five seasons, Stephen, that we saw an increase in overall rush rate for college football teams. It was very small, but it had been negative the last 5 years. So that means that from like 2020 to 2021, teams were passing more. 21 to 22 passing, right, but from 23 to 24, teams actually rushed more.
Is that because the RPO is, and this is my inner spiritual defensive coordinator, like dubious and you know, cheating? Is that because a lot more teams just said, you know what, if we lean on RPO here, we can probably get away with a few more?
If I can't block you, I can just isolate you and make you
I can
choose,
make
right?
you think it's a run play and then throw exactly. it over your head. Okay. You put out a beautiful infographic. Well done. Excellent. Design, clearly a passion of yours. It was early February, on offensive line continuity in America's conference for offensive linemen, regardless of what happens, which is the Big Ten. The national champion Ohio State Buckeyes, as I read this, it made absolutely no sense to me. So basically what you have is percentage of snaps by highest used player at each position. Okay. All year, I think, if I'm interpreting this as an idiot, you took how consistently were they using one player at these positions? Is that right?
Yes. It's the percentage of total snaps that was taken by the player who played the most snaps. Now, so if you played five centers, who was the center who played the most? What percentage of total snaps did he play?
So it's not so much about what their experience was, which is kind of the bigger question that we're asking today. But the first thing that jumps out at me is that, okay, well, the national championship team, like they're in the red in your graph. In other words, like center's 55%, left guard was 30%, left tackle 52%. It seems like on the right side of the line, they were a little bit more consistent. And then I go down to a team that had a bad season, Michigan State, Purdue. They're heavy in the blue, 80, 97. Center was used 98% of the snaps. Yeah, you know, Purdue, the right side of their line, 95% or higher. So it's not so much that you're using the same guys out there and having consistent starters. This is just I interpret this as talent is much more important here than like necessarily having guys get their, you know, the unit be cohesive or everyone get their snaps and understand. If you have a better player at that position, it doesn't matter how often they play. They're just going to do a better job in whatever situation you put them in, right?
Right. I actually made those charts kind of hoping to explain why teams had bad seasons and was kind of flipped on my head a little bit because I did see like Purdue and Michigan State and Northwestern all had a lot of continuity at key positions on the offensive line. And the reality there is what comes out is other teams. So Ohio State, we know there's some issues with injury and they had to move some guys around.
Right.
And some of that. But like Oregon, a lot of continuity there. But at the right guard position, they moved around because they had the depth to say this player is not up to snuff. We're going to try something else here. Whereas Purdue and Northwestern, those are your offensive linemen. Like if they're healthy, these are the guys we've got to play. And so your options are a little bit limited, which comes back to team building of how important depth is at the offensive line and why those like upper tier Big Ten conference teams can have perceived offensive line instability and still succeed is because they have the depth of the roster and the talent to say, oh, we're going to make a change. Whereas Purdue and Northwestern are saying, hey, we got a 4-star, like the guy behind him is a math major walk on, like we're not going to put him out there. And so they're a little bit more handcuffed.
Yeah. As I go through this chart, like the more blue, which again, I know people are listening to this. It basically means the higher percentage the single person played. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of bad teams on here. And then there's red all over. Like Minnesota had a successful season here. Okay. Like you just mentioned Oregon in the right guard, Ohio State, very red. Like it just, I guess I don't want to defeat my point already, but this is a talent issue. So let me kind of bridge off of this. Does this mean that you may not have the data for this. You could just say, hey, it's too subjective. Can we still keep the idea, the stereotype of the offensive line the same in the portal era? As long as it's a good player at that position, it doesn't matter if they've played next to the guy, next to the center, next to the guard for 2.5 seasons.
Yeah, the way I approached kind of that year-over-year continuity issue was twofold. And one of them was kind of asking, I went and hollered at my friend Jeff Schwartz and asked him, you know, offensive line guru, former NFL player, and said, hey, if this theory is true, if there's more instability in the offensive lines, what would you expect to see out of teams to try to facilitate more plug and play where you can minimize the fact that the development and experience matters? And he suggested looking at frequency of run, which we talked about. He talked about the frequency of inside zone and how more condensed the offensive schemes were. And we've seen from 23 to 24, inside zone raised by about 1.4 percentage points. So again, a small increase, more teams are running inside zone. There's less diversity of concepts. He also mentioned fewer formations, more window dressing. And so you look at the change in motion rates since 2019, I mean, there's been a 3%, 2.5 to 3% increase every year in percent of pre-snap motion on all plays for all FBS teams.
So this is something I learned when I was embedded way back in the sort of like Western Kentucky days. It's also, they nickname it, call it Shoshin, which is shift and motion. So it's taking the same play and just putting some business on it before the snap and making it look different. Now, this leads me to, when you talk about condensed, what you're saying basically is, we're going to simplify it? Is condensed and simplification the same?
Yeah, or just we're going to reduce the menu of run concepts that we have. You can't run the full Lincoln Riley, you know, GT, GY, GH, GC, nine different types of counter and have all of that in your bag if you're trying to install that after spring football, frankly.
Yeah.
And so they're saying, hey, we're going to run more inside zone and we're going to add a shift or a motion to dress that up in different formations. I imagine there's a non-zero effect. I haven't been able to estimate it because we have 1 year of data with this, but I think helmet comms and communication with the quarterback opens up a world of audibles where, again, if you have that knowledge of my offensive line is limited, what are the combinations of the simple things I can do as opposed to doing fancier and fancier protections, fancier and fancier run schemes as well?
Okay, so what I'm learning here is that I'm going to put a little flourish in the pre-snap, but we can't actually run as more complicated concepts more often. At least maybe not until later in the season. Maybe we can install some things. Right. But I can also tell you as a reporter, the book is sort of the book. Like once the season gets going, unless you have major injury or a coaching change or something catastrophic happened, like there's a book and then there's variation within, like kind of think of it. And I'm again, because podcasting is a visual medium and I'm an idiot, I'm sort of making my hands like almost like a set of parentheses. You have what you can install in the summer. And now we're having guys who are, you know, as we record this, the portal is still open in the spring. Guys come in, they get the book. I'm holding my hands up. Inside of that, you can create an individual game plan for your opponent, but you can't really do much more outside of that book. And so it feels like, or, and I think I can see things on the field, but I'm just a layman. College football schematically might be getting simpler as a result of the portal. That's a big statement, but I think we're headed in that direction.
Especially in the short term, like obviously, you know, there's not going to be a static equilibrium. There's going to be a swing of the pendulum as coaches learn and adapt. But in the short term, I think that's definitely true as you see, you know, a lot of I like to look at something I call game plan variance, which is is going to make me sound like a huge nerd. But is the variance in your relative rush rate over expected? So rush rate, how often do you rush? Rush rate over expected. Accounting for down, distance, yard line, how much do you rush relative to what the average team does facing the situations that you're in? Relative rush rate over expected is how much did you do that? How much did you rush over expected in a game relative to the rest of your season? And then I look at the variance of that. So that's saying how much are you changing kind of your run and pass variance week over week? And the biggest source of variation for teams and how they changed week to week was not the concepts in the run game that they ran, it was the run pass mix. And I think we're seeing that more true in 2024, that you're not going to be able to, you know, invent as many Chip Kelly bells and whistles and 13 personnel and all these new packages. You're going to say, hey, we're going to pass in different situations than we normally did. And that's how we're going to attack more strategically. The RPO helps you tag that as well.
So it's less about I'm going to pull in a new playbook in Madden, and it's much more Tecmo Bowl in a sense of just like, you know what? The computer expects me to throw on 3rd and 13, but we're actually going to run in that situation. This is the dumbest, simplest way I can do this, by the way. I apologize.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I'm imagining there's like a coach listening to this who's throwing his headset and yelling at us for not knowing ball. But, you know, I think, again, that's a short-term equilibrium.
Here.
Yeah. So I'm not on the sideline, right?
No, that's why we're, yeah. I think because it, but this is a little bit of like Occam's razor, because while it is cliche to say that some of this stuff, like, you know, the development, the cohesiveness, you know, I'm kind of picking on offensive line here today, but it's the one that usually is kind of rife with the most cliches. And it was also the one whose persona was built up the most by the traditional collegiate structure of locking a guy in on a scholarship, redshirting him, and keeping him in a system, usually 2.5-3 years before you sort of he was relevant. There weren't a ton of like freshman left tackles that came right. in as 5 stars and became household names overnight, right? Like there aren't that many Orlando Paces in the world. So this is why I wanted to pick on O-line. Is there a way to look at, let's just say, and this is, you know, I spend the spring talking to coaches. They're always hyperbolic and they're always dramatic about, oh God, we lost our whole roster. I think in reality, let's say the turnover is going to live somewhere in the neighborhood of 35-38% of the roster. I'm kind of making that up right now. If that's the case moving forward, is there anything that you've seen from a data standpoint that feels like, you know, if you went in as a consultant at a major Power Four program and you knew that you're turning over 38% of your roster every single year now, and you don't get that long to install it, and you don't get that much time during the week, people, I've said this 1,000 times, people really would be surprised at how little you actually practice in college versus the NFL. Would your data say, because of this, go here or eliminate this? Or is there still room for variance and we just haven't figured it out?
I think there is, and there's probably, and I will defer to the coaches on this, there's probably an edge in install and practice stuff that I know nothing about to mm-hmm. make your menu of plays you can run bigger and teach them. I think it's important to look at some key transfers who have succeeded and figure out kind of what system they were in and notice a pattern. So like, I think about Osiris Torrance, who went from Louisiana to Florida, followed Billy Napier, was playing in the same system. So like okay. Florida turned over the roster, but Napier had that guy in his system. He knew those were similar. You think about TCU's run in 2022, Alana Lee came over from SMU and was an anchor in the center of that offensive line that like they would not have succeeded without. He was a Dykes guy. He knew the system. You think about Lance Leipold at Kansas brought out Mike Nowitzki and 3 or 4 other guys from Buffalo and was able to take a MAC offensive line and just mm-hmm. whoop on people at Kansas because they knew the system. And so there's kind of like this false continuity there where, you know, by the numbers of returning production and roster continuity, it looks like, oh, we're getting new guys. But I think the edge here and what you'd be looking for is, okay, what are our quote unquote feeder systems? What are the G5 teams that are running similar systems to us? Who's in our coaching tree? And what guys can we kind of fake that continuity by they're familiar with the system and we can just bring them in?
All right, then let me walk that out a little bit, because as I've gone through spring rosters with some coaches and done a little bit of the sort of gossip thing that I do, this is just a case study I want to pull. It does involve a transition up in terms of subdivision, so the talent thing might, I don't know if this is going to shake out. Let's talk about Washington State. Jimmy Rogers did not come alone. Like a lot yeah. of South Dakota State came with him. Now, there's a lot of examples here. Like, you know, off the top of my head, I could have thought about, okay, like the James Madison import to Indiana last year, or I think this is the record so far. We're not done with the portal. Marshall has 17 players going to Southern Miss. But I think it's yep. that actually maybe a little bit more defense. So does Washington State, do I look at them differently in terms of first year we're installing from scratch? And is this something that I can carry over to other case studies and say, it's like not a year, it's not year zero, year one. It's like, it's something plus. Do they get like a percentage point for this? Is that a smart way to look at it?
Yeah, I mean, and it's really hard. And you know, shout out to Bill Conley, who I use his returning numbers. Like he does a great job with some of the empirics there on that. And I do think that we do have to rethink what it means to have returning production, because not mm-hmm. like we're seeing not all snaps are created equal. Like you get an air raid guy and he might be a good tackle. You think about like a Charles Cross or something, you know, in his from Mississippi State, his knock in the NFL was like, oh, he's an air raid guy. He can't run block. And he can. He's fine. He's fine NFL lineman. Like that worked out. But that those kind of evals are said out loud for a reason. And so I do think that there is some kind of weighting kind of two ways. So one, you think about the system continuity, like especially moving up from a lower level. You look at the James Madison or the South Dakota State import that we're seeing this year at Washington State. There is an element of culture building at the FCS level that those guys can come into a team like Washington State and play cohesively and compete with an edge because they're familiar with the system. You look at the alternate of like Kingsley Suamatia dropped down from Oregon to BYU and was like a stalwart tackle for them because the talent level was different. So he came down, the continuity doesn't matter as much. And so the way I would think about it is if you, this is a huge data gathering exercise, but if you could think about like chain transfers and identify, okay, what is our, where are our feeder systems? Who's running similar systems to us? And then who are the starters there? I know, you know, I helped a couple Power Five programs this offseason with just looking at starters and the G5 level. And it's like, who played the most snaps? They didn't even want to get into the schematic stuff yet. They just want to said, we value experience because we know we're going to have to plug holes and we can't take the risk of an inexperienced guy alongside other new starters as well. So we want someone who has shown they can play football consistently. So I think what we're looking at instead of like points for, you know, what are the seasons in different, like prior in their career? I think what we're looking at is kind of twofold of one, are they in a similar system? And two, at the tail end, the top end of experience, that's actually going to have compounding effects on the rest of your offensive line because the uncertainty of a guy who can play consistently is smaller.
Okay. Then with that in mind, you are a player, you are going to a group of five program. You're a freshman, you have a good year, sophomore, whatever, you hit the portal. It feels like that first school that you sign with, if you have any hope of or any idea that, hey, I might transfer, I might get a shot and move up, it feels like there's some pressure to have a sort of sameness amongst systems. Because if you're too far afield of what most of college football is running, your learning curve would be considered an impediment against you at the next school that you might get a look at where there's 50,000 more in NIL or there's just a plan, you know, like if I could step up from the MAC to the American to the ACC or whatever. Is that
right?
That's kind of alarming, actually, because one of the things that we all love about college football is the sort of diversity of thought, diversity of like everything, personnel, schematic. I want to jump to the American for a second. Like,
yeah,
a lot of those offenses look similar to me, right? Like there are some concepts that are really, really successful that are working in the American. Like when I went through and did my Athlon preview there, there were a lot of schools where it's like, hey, they know what they're doing on offense. They're really good at it. Defensively, they're trying to like pull an entire import in, right? It seems like we'll go back to offensive line for a second. You could probably jump between UTSA, UNT, you know, potentially what FAU is going to run. Like, it seems like that, like, there's a way you could move in and maybe cut down on some of this learning curve if everyone is just, if it's just like, hey, you know what, we're doing really the same thing philosophically. The verbiage is different on our team or the, you know, this OC says something different. But man, like, I'm kind of talking myself into a world where everyone, it's almost like computer programming. Like, you have to learn a language like C++. And if you don't program with that, or, you know, you're Linux instead of whatever, man, I'm so out of my depth saying this, but like, if you're... If something is boutique, it's going to be held against you as a player.
Yeah, I think that's there's potential at the extremes. Like on average, I think there is a lot of similarity. Also, it's funny, like the two schools you mentioned and then FAU are like Kittley's at FAU now. Like they're all running the Texas offenses. Like they are very similar and could plug and play. If I was a coach that wasn't running an air raid and had like more complex run game, for instance, I definitely would mention that in my recruiting and be like, hey, if you want to get developed and maximize your opportunities, like we're going to teach you the language of diverse run schemes and you're going to be able to plug into a lot of systems. Like I think sharp coaches are getting into that kind of feeder sounds so derogatory, but that developmental kind of launch pad system and a sharp coach could really maximize that by kind of understanding the market here and looking how teams are moving across. So the interchangeability is fluid. And I do think that like at the extremes, you could look at like a Jacksonville State offensive lineman and say, okay, he played 500 snaps at Jacksonville State. Great. He's probably not coming to the SEC to run like a power offense or even like Kalen DeBoer's offense, where there's going to be a lot more true pass sets, where there's going to be a lot more kind of one-on-one blocking against, you know, high elite athletes because they're doing all this quick game and pulls and all this stuff. Like you can see some obvious extreme examples of, oh, that's probably not going to translate, that I'm sure coaches are, you know, aware of into, but flesh out a little bit more back to that idea of like, what's our tree? What are the schools that are running similar stuff? Who's excelling there? That's how we get the feeder programs.
You've sent me another graph and we're going to describe it again to our audience who can't see anything right now. And this is offensive lineman who played at least 100 snaps in consecutive years from 2020 to 2024.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting to look at, like, the movements and the trends that mm-hmm. we have here. We see that in 2020, which, again, weird year, we have to caveat that, but yeah. about 6% of Power 5 offensive linemen who were returning starters, that's what the 100 snap filter does, just saying you were involved in some way, though, okay. About 6% of those guys were playing on new teams in 2020 relative to 2019. Less than 1% of G5 players that were returning were playing on new teams. We've seen that grow substantially to the point, Stephen, in 2024, over 20% of the returning Power 5 linemen in 2024 were on new teams last year.
So there's five guys on an offensive line. That's one out of five.
That's one in five. One in five new starters, not accounting for guys that have graduated and filled by a developmental program in terms wow. of that. But the turnover has become huge. The G5 has actually lagged way behind that because G5 is becoming that developmental program because your guys are getting poached to go to the Power 5 and you yeah. have to replace with the high school ranks and all of that. So we're seeing the natural kind of developmental farm system in a de facto taking place here. G5 is only about 10%, which is still about a half a lineman per school was playing on a different school last year, which is just overwhelming turnover. And frankly, it's the new reality. Like the Power 5 is going to be, the top of the Power 5 is going to be plugging holes at offensive line with guys that have played years at the G5 level.
So this is unavoidable, essentially, because if you're not competing, you're not trying to go out and improve in the portal, you will get left behind. Obviously, defenses are improving. Defenses are allowed to recruit in the portal. So we're now shifting this one stat alone says we've all, you know, there are no more Dabos in this situation. Everyone is committed to going out and improve, at least evaluating by position group and saying, can we get a little bit better here? No one is going to come out short of Dion and say, we're going to flip this thing because that's how we want to build. We don't want 75 new guys. And, you know, those are extreme outliers still. But everyone is going to be bringing in new bodies. Every single program now. So how yeah. do you so now you have to account for this in terms of development, stability, cohesion, et cetera. Okay.
And where this math gets really interesting, you've seen the same numbers I have about the market rates for a high school tackle versus a portal tackle, right? Yeah, I mean, is anyone in a college building doing the math on the discounted future value of a high school offensive tackle, factoring in the fact that top-end talent is more likely to transfer, that the market rates for transfer offensive linemen are super high right now, and the uncertainty of a high school tackle is much higher than the uncertainty of a premium mm-hmm. kind of established starter in the portal. I think those questions are stuff that, like, coaches are going to have to answer for because you're making strategic decisions against the cap now.
All right. So you and I are sitting around and we're building NIL out. We've been given X amount of dollars by the university. I want you to take me back to that for a second, because everyone might not be as familiar as we are inside the industry. If you're paying a lot out of high school, it might not be the safest way to invest your money. That's the generic sentiment right now. The problem is that hurts to even say out loud because it's counterintuitive to what every person in this industry, media, coach, analyst, whatever, still says, which is you have to build out of high. The core of your roster, we think, should still be the spine, shoulders, and back, should still be guys that you signed who were in your program for 3.5 years that you met when they were 16 at a camp, right? So yeah. But these two things are directly combative.
It's hard because look at, I mean, Ohio State, for all the stuff they got about the $20 million roster. I mean, a lot of those guys, they plugged key holes with transfers, but a lot of those guys were homegrown and they were able to do that. In the middle, I think, is where it gets more conflated. And you're seeing a couple trends there. One, you're seeing teams give a lot of offers strategically, knowing that a guy is not going to come right now, but you've established a relationship where if he gets in the transfer portal, you could get him to, you could, you know, get that relationship going again and then try to get him to come back to you. And so there's a lot more like strategic kind of gamification of the recruiting offers because the relationships matter because you've got that guy's phone number now and he's talked to you before. And that gives you a leg up on the transfer portal. That also, I mean, I've talked to Power 5 coaches who are trying to work on strategies for buy-in to help their high school recruits understand, like, we want to pay you a lot of money when you're playing, but like we, for our locker room, we don't want to have a lot of money tied up into guys that are not going to be on the field right now or not going to be key contributors. So like they're trying to work on selling the vision of come here and develop and stay because they're worried about, hey, if we don't pay you a lot, someone else will pay you a lot when you're ready. But then you flip that against the sunk cost of, hey, well, I didn't pay you a $500,000 signing bonus to never see a snap on the field, and that kind of trade-off there. So it is kind of hard. And I think there's, going back to the South Dakota State thing I said about like the culture aspect, I think there is a little bit of renaissance of which coaches can actually instill culture and kind of get players to buy into the vision of coming and developing and sticking around. Credit to Sonny Dykes at TCU. Like Josh Hoover could have, you know, gotten life-changing money, and he's doing well at TCU. He's fine. They took care of him. But he said no. He said no to go to the SEC and build on this program. And so they've got the buy-in for that as well. I think that's kind of a mental calculus that is maybe familiar to coaches, but maybe it just kind of rhymes with the old way that they built culture and kind of got that developmental program.
TCU, a notoriously modest campus with modest alum. Shout out to Landman. It sounds like a little bit, and again, God, I just feel like I'm hitting the freaking buzzer every time I walk into a cliche. This is not so much the rich getting richer, but it definitely feels like the rich of the sport will be insulated from this problem, because if you overpay, overpay is a big finger quote motion. We don't really understand market value yet. But if you are scared of investing a lot in the 4 or 5 star tackle coming out of high school, because one, he might not be that good, or two, you're going to develop him for someone else. If you're Alabama, you're going to take that risk. If you're, you know, if you're one of the powers or the haves, that's fine, because one, we've got the money. We can spend, and if we lose one guy but we develop three others, great, it's going to work out in the aggregate. But if you're in that middle range, I mean, I'm just going to randomly pick on a school for a second. Let me go back to the American in that fulcrum space. If I'm South Florida or Memphis, okay, why am I going out and recruiting and spending money in one of those two recruiting areas specifically on a 4-star high school tackle? Because damn, if it doesn't... If this kid is at or above expectation by his sophomore year, I just paid to build someone else's home for them, right?
Yep.
So what do I? So do I take my 22 and I say, let's get 2 3-stars instead?
I think there's a lot of ways to skin a cat there, and I think the shakedown of or shakeout of like the Nico situation and his brother going out to UCLA, Arkansas is demanding some money back, and whether that's going to be enforceable or not will tell us a lot about how that works. I think it's worth pointing out that the key issue for losing those guys is one for the lower levels on field success. It's the principal agent. It's not like, hey, we're going to be against the cap, or hey, we're going to be the New Orleans Saints and have all these insane cap problems that are going to prevent us from succeeding in the future. It's, hey, I'm going to lose my job if I don't win football games, and I need good players to win football games. So the principal agent problem there is a little bit different than the NFL. It's interesting. Like I still think there's a big space for a team to steer into that and say like, yes, come here and go get recruited. Like, come here and ball out for 2 years and then go get your SEC money, dude. Like, we will build you up. That's great. I think the kind of soccer style idea of like registering with a club and then getting buyouts from that is really good. I've talked to a MAC program that is really reluctant to make early offers. They talk to kids, they get them in, because they have noticed that when they make an early offer, there are Big Ten schools that swoop in. They're kind of outsourcing their talent to these lower level schools and letting them filter of like, okay, among these lower level prospects, who should we look at? And as soon as they get an offer from a couple of these key schools, these Power Five teams are going in and getting them. But I don't think it's only squeezing the American. I don't want to, this is not dancing on graves or anything, but it's wild to see Deion Sanders call out Virginia for trying to tamper with his players when the reality of money came down and like, oh, we can lose guys too, and that how this is not a one-sided market, and how, oh shoot, other people can do this as well. We can't just become like, oh, come here and play. I think there's a lot of like level setting expectations for coaches as they realize everybody's trying to play ball here.
Okay. So it's not necessarily all flowing in a linear direction. It's not that simple. I, of course, I'm going to kind of lean in on that G5 side and sort of do the woe is. I want to go back for a second, because you said that you think you could lean into this. Could you, and this is me dipping into a sport I know even less about, for a while at Kentucky, John Calipari had a thing where he would go out and find the best available talent and sell kid X directly on, you are here for 1 year. And then maybe you're going to get drafted. Maybe it's the second round of the NBA draft. Maybe you're going to get drafted. So he, for a while, kind of runs a hot streak of, it's these five and these two or three on the bench this year. And then we're going to figure out next year when next year comes. If I was like a Florida Atlantic, is that something in this, like, and to go back again to this position group that we started the show with, offensive linemen's bodies don't really work that way. Like, how could I do that? Are we JUCOing? Is that, are we going to turn half of the FBS into a JUCO?
I think that's interesting because, like, not to talk down on JUCO, like a great vehicle for guys to go and get what they need to get right and get on the field.
Yeah,
but like,
totally,
there's a reason a lot of those guys are not at programs to start. So they become much harder to bring into the locker room and develop, whether that's academically or whether that's team building and chemistry. Like, there are legitimate concerns there. And that's why you're JUCO. Tons of JUCO success stories. I think that can happen. I think we'll see a little bit more of like, obviously, we're getting kind of the Premier League style. Like, there's what, 40, 45 teams where like they're playing ball and everybody else is kind of trying to play ball. I wonder if, looking at like the migration patterns of the G5, if we don't start to see, like, South Florida has an amazing facility. Fred Smith is pledging money to Memphis. Like, they have opportunities to, if they're sharp, again, feed off the lower levels. I think one thing that's unique about college football, in addition to having 22 players on a roster at any given time, the coaching changes and the coordinator moves, the carousel that happens is almost unlike any other sport. And kind of being able to be strategic about that and say, oh, there's a diaspora when a coach changes, we can go kind of agglomerate some of that, you know, and become a G5 all-star team by saying, hey, if your coach leaves, come here. We're playing big games. We've got money and you might not get an SEC offer, but like, we think you're really, really good. I think that's a role for like Memphis and South Florida to say, we can kind of carve out this like top of the second tier, upper middle class existence by being smart there. I think you're looking at the MAC teams or the ones that the Mountain West teams are steering into the development, the Sun Belt, and saying, we want culture fits. We want the right guys. Don't go be a bench rider at the SEC. Come here and be all conference for 4 years and get taken in day three of the draft. I think those are kind of the narratives. We're getting away from the data here a little bit, but just looking at the movement trends and everything, I think that's really what we're looking at is, with this instability, it's how many ways can coaches come up with an edge to capitalize on what is a really, really uncertain market.
All right, last question before I get to the summary. In this hypothetical development program, could I almost operate sort of a first and second class citizen culture, which is tough to do in a locker room? If I can grab a 3 or 4 star wide receiver and I'm in one of these American or, you know, Sun Belt cultures where it's like, hey, there's a lot of good high school ball in these states, I'm going to go ahead and do it and say, you know what? I'm South Al. I'm going to get you ready for Auburn or wherever, right? And it's good that this 3.5 star kid is here. But I know at the end of the sophomore season, he's probably out of there. Simultaneous to that, I then sort of look at this offensive line position or elsewhere and say, you know what? I'm going to pull FCS kids. I'm going to go to the high schools and find 2 star long-term projects, because maybe it's a mix. And this is just, I don't know, I'm throwing it against the wall, where if I'm not a high-end top 30 program that is just going to kind of spin their way out of this problem, because one of the lessons we learned here today is talent is talent, right? Talent is talent. It didn't, you know, my theory in the offensive line doesn't hold water all the way through, because like, if you're bringing in 5 strangers who are all really good at playing offensive line, they're probably really good at playing offensive line. Could I operate maybe where certain position groups, I'm almost just being like, you know what? We're just going to be a development program and these guys are going to be super unsexy, but we're going to go chase, like, all of our wide receivers might change every year. Is that, I mean, maybe that works. I don't know. I mean, I'm not asking you for affirmation because no one knows, but it just seems like I would be out of my mind right now if I was in charge of personnel and I didn't have a $10 million NIL behind me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the way to find an edge in that market and come up with an alternative strategy like that of like, these are the positions we're going to rotate on, these are the ones we're going to invest in, is kind of twofold. Is one, if I got hired as a player personnel director or a GM tomorrow, first thing I'm doing, coach, we're interviewing, talk me through your scheme on both sides of the ball, 1 through 22, rank them. Like, tell me what's most important for you to succeed and what you need everywhere. Right. And then we can go geographically and say like, okay, you need corn-fed interior offensive lineman. Great. We're going to the Midwest for that. Yeah. You need just monstrous defensive tackle that's a run stopper. Great. Southeast. I know where we're going. I know where those guys are. How competitive are we in those markets? Like, what resources can we devote to those to make sure we get those talent while not missing out on our bread and butter? And that kind of will reveal where you should spend money in that. I think additionally, schematic innovation is something that is really fun about college football. People do weird stuff. And I mentioned George Tech and Vanderbilt. If you have that sense of identity, 1 through 22, you can say, oh God, our right tackle is awful. We can never put him in a one-on-one situation mm-hmm. against a defensive end. Great. I know what's going in my playbook because of that. I know how to try to scheme around that and manage that. And I know, okay, I'm not going to go overpay for a marginally better upgrade here. I'm going to try to get someone in next year and see if I can scheme around it for now and then turn him over. I think it would be a really enlightening experience, Stephen, for coaches, mm-hmm. and I'm not selling anything or advocating here anything here, to go to something like PFF and just filter for tackles that had a 70 grade or above and played, you know, 100, 150 snaps, and just look at what could I get. I think there's an opportunity cost to roster turnover that in college football, you can do a lot worse than a bad player in a lot of situations. And realizing how scarce talent is at different positions helps inform not only your positional importance and how that aligns with like where are potential upgrades in the market, but also where do I need to invest time and resources to schematically update because I can't go get another guy. I'm going to kick this tackle who had a 72 PFF grade who annoys the ever-loving hell out of me, and I'm going to get a guy who's going to come in and be, you know, a below average tackle because that's all there is on the market. Like, that kind of analysis is super important here to understand. I can't just willy-nilly, not picking on any coach, say, hey, get out of here, you're bad. I'm going to get all brand new players in here every year and they're all going to be better. That's just not going to happen. You've got to be strategic about that.
All right. So here's what we've learned today. One, I've avoided talking about Vanderbilt because I'm trying to stay away from my tendencies, and they are running the triple option, America. You just need to figure that out. Okay. All that preaching I did for 20 odd years and someone beat Ala freaking Bama with the highest 247 star composite roster in history running the triple option. But I'm going to get off that soapbox. Here's what we learned. Talent is talent. So my theory might be flawed here because talent is talent. And if I plug in five great guys, regardless if they didn't know each other's names at summer camp, they're still probably going to mull your ass over. See Ohio State. RPO on the increase. That sound you hear in the distance is a bunch of defensive coordinators just going to the lake because defensive coordinators love the lake and just screaming out into the night. If you didn't know this, defensive coordinators universally hate the RPO. Absolutely. It's just one of the they basically think it's a downfall of football. We're seeing a shift towards sameness potentially because the market is demanding that kids essentially speak a common language when it comes to scheme, at least on offense. So that sameness is potentially good for personnel on the move, potentially good for a roster that's trying to fill gaps or a lot of holes quickly. But we as fans may not love that if everyone's running the same damn system in 5 years. Development. But we have not yet found a solution. If you are at any level or any part of the strata of have not, it seems like we have not seen someone come in and solve for X there yet. Did I get all that right?
That sounds right to me. Yeah.
All right. Parker Fleming, as always, thank you for your intellect and educating the idiots, myself included.
Enjoy talking with you.